first of two. Tomorrow's session will be how to take steps to prevent that crumbling. Carl, let's see, and away we go. Well, we'll be looking today at not just the shambles of a crumbled community and how to discern it. It usually isn't too hard to do. I'd like to suggest that without infringing too much on Tom Droege's territory, that we'll be wanting to deal with seeing to it that there's some healing for this. And I'm going to try to move in on four different areas of community life. There probably are more, but I think these categories that I'm going to be listing here will be sufficiently umbrella-ish to cover most of our concerns. The first of these, of course, is the community of among neighbors. Second one is at the workplace. The third is in the family. I'm not putting these down in order of importance. I'm just putting them, not even in alphabetical order. And the fourth is that we'll concern ourselves with this church community. One doesn't have to be a great chronicler of the times to discover that there are serious breakdowns in community in all those areas. But what we'd like to do to begin with is to try to zero in on the rupture factor in communities. I think we can detect what the symptoms or the marks of a healthy community are rather easily, or the ideal community. In a neighborhood community, it's where there's a spirit of trust, congeniality, people being aware of what is going on in each other's lives without being too snoopy necessarily, but to be sensitive to the fact that there are some problems going on and to be somewhat empathetic towards those problems. So to look and see where a neighborhood has developed community, we aren't going to be using the books, so relax about those. A community that is healthy is fairly obvious. I think that few, let's put it this way, that very few neighborhoods in 1992 developed this in any extended fashion. There are very, very few communities that really determinedly and intentionally and with a little energy really are committed to establishing a healthy and warm community. More often than not, a neighborhood community is a temporary thing, or it is it has its formal aspects. For example, some neighborhoods have developed block programs in which they'll agree that if any kid is coming home from school and has trouble, they can run into certain houses and they'll have a refuge, whether it's a barking dog or a suspicious man riding around offering candy or whatever it is, or if a place to go if they suddenly go home and find that their parents are missing. That's a sort of a very, very superficial but important community factor, and a lot of communities never get to that point. The ones that have block parties and maybe twice a year will invite everybody together so they can welcome new members of the community and eat a couple of cool weenies and warm pop, block off the street, maybe dance a little and have music. That's okay. Very often the entire family is invited and the youth may stay to eat, or the youth will run the place and have their kind of music, and the old people will wilt off to the sides. But I'm talking about the situations that can develop. I remember one that I thought was an ideal community where, when we were living in Tulsa, and it must have been ideal because we got an award from the National Conference of Christians and Jews, but we sensed that because it was a changing neighborhood, there was panic in the neighborhood, and we went through some very decided, determined steps in order to meet with various people in our homes, have coffee and discussion with them, and let them know what's going on in this community, and to dispel the fear factor and all the predictions of the city planners that this community would, in a year and a half, change from all white to all black. That took about 10 years, and it did change, but there was no panic selling, even though there were some very disturbing, traumatically disturbing interruptions, like the first home of a black person who moved in was, the front wall was rubbed with human feces, and two of the new neighbors had crosses burned on their lawn, and then a fourth in a situation, a house was bombed. So, really, rather hefty things, but they were the impulse and the generating factor, the catalyst for our saying something has to be done because people are just going to panic and move out. And in one sense, there wasn't any great socializing in the community, but there was a determined effort on the part of the people to visit people who were moving, visit people who were moving in, and visiting with people who were on the brink and who were being bothered by the blockbusting real estate kind of folks. So that was so focused that it forfeited some of the other values. There was a strong response to what's going on in the school when some of the parents were objecting that now there were little black first graders sending little Valentines to their other first graders, and the parents were thinking maybe we ought not have Valentines anymore because this could promote interracial marriage. But getting past some of those things in the school and actually helping the school to become such a very good one that people from the far east side of Tulsa who were with the best employed and the best financed and the nicest homes, they were busing their children to, what was the name of the school?
John Burroughs
School, because it was such a quality school, and we insisted that it be that. And it was better than some of the suburban schools, and those enlightened parents wanted to have their children get a good education in a multicultural setting. Incidentally, that got no notice in any of the Associated Press releases about the evils of busing, where the people had voluntarily determined to do it. Well, I didn't want to belabor that one too long, but I do have to say we did not achieve this that all the neighbors knew each other, but it was a group of people who really took charge of the situation and would meet with people and assure them that this is a good neighborhood, don't leave it, and as a matter of fact, the house values did not sink in that community. The blacks who did move in actually improved their property, were able to share this, and so there's a feeling of almost security, and I want to use that term because I allude to it in just a few moments. At the workplace, when everybody collaborates and cooperates, and sometimes unions did a great deal to affect a good community because the union pulled the people together to stand against an oppressive management. On the other hand, sometimes the union itself began showing favoritism to different classifications or strata within the union, and that would mess things up, and people would become jealous of each other, and there was not a collaboration, but there was distrust, and that could very often come apart. In families, what's the ideal community? I remember, I think I mentioned this in one of our earlier sessions when Mike Burr was here, my father having made the comment that It was such a wonderful thing to see a certain family of our church membership in church every Sunday, and the father sitting on this end of the pew, five kids in between, and the mother on the other side. He said, that is really beautiful that a family has that. And my mother said, he hasn't talked to his wife for 3 years. And so the family hadn't crumbled in the sense that the five kids were still home, the husband and wife were right together, and the community thought, oh, this is a good, real good family, except some people who were in the know. Actually, there had been a crumbling of that community long ago. And divorce is not the signal of or even a runaway child is, it may be an ultimate symptom, but it's like when the leg is cut off and say, well, that must be gangrene. The gangrene started a long time ago. The symptoms weren't recognized, and then the thing becomes so severe that something that drastic has to happen. There are far more subtleties in the family, and it's not all much of the unrest in a family may be far from crumbling, because there are just a whole lot of circumstances that are constantly throwing people who are in a close situation together in situations that will be calling for almost clash. The kindergartner has a lot different demands that she makes on the family than the eighth grader who is just going into Boy Scouts, or the senior in high school is going to her first prom, or the fellow who's off to college and has to have a car and a few more things. Some of those things are quite, they go with the turf. The husband feeling he's got to have everything ready because he's got to be at work at 6 o'clock, and the wife who is, you know, same dishes, same, if that's her model, that she's been the house manager. There are going to be tensions just by virtue of that, but that doesn't mean necessarily that the community is crumbling. There are great possibilities for things to happen, that people emerge from that with even stronger relationships and ties with each other. In the church, and you know, that's the last place where we would expect any kind of disunity. There's always been a, you know, in volumes, not by gallons, but by the tankfuls. And that's sort of sad. Some of that happens probably because when people go into a church, they have expectations based on invalid assumptions. They expect to have something there that pleases them, instead of understanding that a church is begun with the purpose of pleasing God. And there's all the difference in the world. Now, that may be an oversimplification. After all, certainly in family we expect to do the same thing, but it doesn't always come off that way. Now, the point of rupture is hard to detect. You know, when is a person finally able to discern, hey, our community is falling apart or has fallen apart? I think there are probably many times when it is falling apart, when there are cracks and we can do some cementing. But when the rupture finally takes place, not finally, but begins to take place, it's going to have a decided end to it. Everybody really would love to rush into the breach, literally, and see what we can do for mending. And probably most helpful of anything is to come down to the fact that when a community starts or begins or forms, having gone all through the meeting and conversation and listening to each other, ultimately you will find that not everybody fits into a community because of what different people's needs are.
How are you defining community? I mean, I think of your workplace, for example, people have to be there because they're employed. At what point would you say this is not just people working together, but a community?
It's the same thing in neighborhood, church, or anything else. You don't have community simply because people are all in the same place. I think that people idealize and almost idolize the community that's at Holden. And I think some of that is myth, too. Now, have I said a poison word here?
No, I'll just come up here a little time.
Yeah. Well, why do you... I know why I say it, but what's your reaction as you hear me say that? I'd like to hear it from you. Have you found community here? It would probably be one good quick place to get to this. Let's try to stay away just from the formal definition to find out what you feel about community. Do you think there's community here? Stephen, you're willing to commit yourself to that?
Yeah, there is a community here. I think it gets back to the semantics of how you're defined community.
Okay, how would you... You just used it, so let's see how you frame it.
Group of people living together here. Yeah, that's probably a very...
No, keep going. I'm just going to push you with it a little bit, not to put you in a spot, but just keep defining it a little farther, broaden it a little bit more.
They're sharing infrastructure. They're sharing.
What do you mean by infrastructure?
Buildings, utilities, what power there is.
And preparing food.
Food, I think that gets into an even closer community than the definition I would start with.
Okay.
And I think that's where they start to get where lines need to be drawn about what type of community.
Uh-huh.
But I think just in the general sense of one spot, living their lives in orbits that revolve around common things.
Yeah, no, that's a key word, common. Now, in one sense, at a workplace, everybody who works there has that in common, that they're working. In a family, they all under the same roof and possibly have the same parents, maybe not, but at least there's agreement that they will be living together there. And that's that in common. In a neighborhood, they all live on such and such streets in the such and such a ward, and they have that in common. In a church, they all belong to Redeemer Lutheran Church, and they have that in common. Now, we all sort of back away from settling for that least common denominator as being really essentially the ideal community, and I think that's what we're trying to shoot for. Okay, I was the one who made the charge that I don't think that Holden is an ideal community. And I stand to be corrected, but let's... Why would you say that? Would you agree with me?
Oh yeah, I think in the same way that my family is not an ideal family. I think we all have concept what the ideal family is. It's the same way we have a concept. You have a concept in your mind of what the ideal community is. Uh-huh. And I think that it's probably going to vary between each of us.
Okay, when you said that you don't believe that Holden is an ideal community, what do you have in mind for community? I'm just pushing it a little bit. So
no.
And I hate to put you on the spot.
Yeah. I guess I hadn't thought about it that much. The aspect of the setting here that it touches me the most is how far it differs from my life outside of Holden.
Uh-huh.
Because I'm single and live in an apartment complex, and I don't know many of my neighbors, and neighbors I do know are transient, and they come and go, and I didn't come and go. I've only been there 3 years. And so I don't have a real sense of, I don't have relatives in the area. All of my relatives live out of state. So I'm kind of separated from my family. So the aspect of life at Holden that touches me the most is being able to talk with people and share two meals in a row with someone and just getting to know people. And so that sense of closeness is what I look for in the community. Mm-hmm.
Anybody else have a comment on that? Pastor?
Well, Carl, we think of the family structure where each is the individual within the family, and there you get to know each other's strengths and weaknesses within the family. Then the family has forgiveness for one another and acceptance of one another, and the person comes into the family because he is secure in that situation, because he is received in a healthy family, let's say. They are not, no one is perfect, but each has its unique personality, and there is acceptance, and then there's a lot of forgiveness, and there's a lot of, you know, points of love as well. Now, a community like Holden, I would think, would be the same way. Young and old come together, but after they've been together a while, they see not just these nice things, but the total human sinful personality begins to show. It comes through. The whole person comes through. There's some weaknesses, there's some strengths, there's some things you like, you don't like. And after, I would think, like a winter season, where the small group is together especially, that these begin to show more and more. And it's like the family has to learn to accept, to forgive, to, you know, support one another, where the person finds within that family structure a security.
Okay.
But it's not everybody, you know, not everybody the same, but there is that kind of struggle, I think,
okay,
that goes on within a
okay
community like this,
all
too,
right,
which is good and which is healthy, I think. If everyone was on a high plane of perfection that we never got, where you never got to know each other, that would be a false kind of situation, I think. But I think where the, like say the community here, where these strengths and weaknesses begin to show in each individual, and the struggles that go on, even within the worship life, let's say, of the Eucharist and forgiveness and helping one another and accepting one another. I think what I hear when young people leave, and, well, older too, but I think with the young people, they feel they are better people totally because I think of some of the struggles that they've gone through in relationships to one another.
Okay, very good. excuse me. Let me ask this question. Do people come here to get community? Do they come here for community?
I think there are expectations of that.
Mm-hmm. Do they get it? I think they do.
I think so. Especially on a long-term basis.
All right, let me go back to that question. Why would anyone want to have community? Now, you know, when you work at a place where you have stuff in common and you move into a place where your neighbor or you go to church, you'd like to have community, and you may have people who have this something in common, but people will quickly say, well, I was really looking for community here. What are they looking for when they say, I would like community? I think everybody would like that. I mean, Greta Garbo may want to be alone, but other than Greta Garbo, what about community? When you say, I want community, what are you looking for?
Well, I think what you're looking for is the kind of thing that Steve was talking about, you were talking about, a place where you can be yourself and be accepted with all the warts and everything else that's showing, and that does involve struggle. But I think you pick and choose where you want that. And you don't go every place expecting to find community. And in a lot of places, you're willing to settle for a kind of pseudo-community where everybody agrees to be nice and hide, you know, the hostilities that may be underneath. And so you do that there. And you get along with the workplace or whatever by agreeing not to deal with any of that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's okay. I don't think you can go every place and have communities.
Yeah, you wouldn't quit work just because some people are ogres there, but you'd just be disappointed, I don't really have community. It seems to me that at the point of community, you know, there are lots of demonstrations of people being alone and being sick and dying.
Tom had a breakdown the other day that was a little different from the one that I very often use, but we were hitting on the same things, and we touched one of the points that you had. Everybody would like to really work. Let me spell it downward instead of sideward. Everybody would really like to have a saner life. And if you don't, you go insane. That's just my way of remembering it. And the first, now I'm not talking about physical needs. We all need food, we all need sleep, we all need bathrooms, we need fresh air to breathe and all that. But other than that, there are psychological needs. The first of these really is, as you said, security. And the next one is affection. And the third one are new experiences. And the fourth one is recognition. And it's a very lonesome life if you are missing on any one of these. And I'm sure lonely people come here, and there's some degree of security that is achieved here. You know, I've mentioned this, and Esther has, we've talked about this when we get to the room in the evening. There isn't put down here. Repeatedly we've said that. You know, you make a real dumb remark here, and nobody puts you down. And that's a very, very beautiful thing, because when people do put you down, it means that they're struggling to assert themselves and to look better than you do. Academic communities are loaded with this. The kind of stratifying that goes on in the workplace, supervisor, management, and so on, also ran custodian. Back to the university, my son Peter one summer got a job with a paint crew after he'd been overseas, and he needed 3 months to make a little bit of money before he went off to another one of his ventures. And he said, Dad, you'd be surprised how the people in maintenance, physical plant, have all the profs pegged, who are the snobs, who are the good guys, and who treat us like trash, and who have respect for us, and so on. And it's there. You never find stratifying in families, do they? And church? Okay. And sometimes churches encourage this too by listing all the officers, and some churches even mention who gives the most money and gives the names of all of them. Not too good. But the security of feeling safe, and that can be very, you know, have its physical aspects too. For a while when we were living in Tulsa, we lived in a sort of a remote area of town. We weren't very popular because we were identifying ourselves right at civil rights time, at the beginning of the ferment of that, and we were rather prominently, exceptionally white people, and our life was threatened at that time too. And we lived on a corner of a hairpin turn at a curb, sort of like a switchback here, and whoever would put the brakes on had to turn to go back up. We were, it was called Reservoir Hill. And we had jalousie windows, so, you know, these little glass things. And so every time a red brake would go on, it would suddenly light up like 15 panes of glass. And it was a lonesome sort of area. One night, several nights, we had women running from cars for safety to our place, and which could be a real setup, you know, if a man is right behind. And they were lonesome things. And I am not, you know, I never won a Golden Gloves contest, or was particularly, I did go out for wrestling when I was in freshman high school, and I gave it up because I got a headache when I was in somebody's headlock. So she didn't really marry a great Roman soldier champion. But we would be scared. But there was something about both of us being home and being close together and snuggling in bed. I mean, it's silly, I mean, because...
It's silly? It was silly?
Yeah, well, you weren't. You're less a fighter than I am. I don't know if you're aware of that. But there is something about that, that there was, we were home, and it was ours, and, you know, and it may not always have been the most intelligent or rational, but it was there. We had security. In the neighborhood, if you have to lock your doors, and by the way, when do people lock their doors? The little towns in Iowa, Wisconsin, places,
People never not lock their doors. When do they start locking their doors?
When they get citified. That's a line from our town. He's just getting citified. He doesn't know he knows he doesn't have anything worth stealing, and so does the rest of the town.
But check it out. Isn't it at the time when you don't know everybody in the community? I don't know this person, or I saw a person walking through the town or down the street whom I don't know. And it's at that moment, this moment of distrust sets in. But
you know, one of the differences between Camp Arcadia, which is a Lutheran family camp, and Holden is that there are locks on all the doors mm-hmm. in Arcadia, and all the rooms and all the buildings are locked when they're closed, and I see very few locks around here.
Mm-hmm. And you don't leave your purse in the room either for any length of time in Arcadia.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But you also don't have to wrap up your food for fear it might lest the Lord gives you this thorn in the flesh, lest you be exalted beyond. Okay, security. Just to test this and push it farther, this is something that the little infant wants. You know, the infant has to have a security blanket. But more than that, there's something insecure about a situation. The child is just out of sorts. Leave it with a stranger. The moment of insecurity is that this is a sort of a coming apart of the scene. And when you're 99 years old, and what are the main political concerns for the 99? Is our Social Security going to make it? You know, are we going to go to this retirement home and they're going to be bankrupt and we're going to be on the street? You know, where's somebody going to take care of it? So it's at every level along the line. This is a profoundly important one. Now, as far as affection is concerned, there are different ways of showing affection, as the pastor here at Holden reminds us when it's the time for the passing of the peace. Surely, the key example that I like to use for myself is this woman sitting here who, on the night of April 14th, I always wait with doing my taxes till then, because if Judgment Day would come before that, why was I wasting my time making out taxes? See, I didn't want to be a poor steward. But suddenly on that 14th of April night, when I'm really pulling stuff together, you know, the pressure's on, and I've got a fuse that's about this long, and this woman slips into the room and doesn't say a word and just puts a cup of hot chocolate in front of me and gets out. And what a neat thing for me. You know, she loves me. I don't have time for it anymore. I don't want, you know, no conversation or anything else. But little children, again, need this affection. And you know, when you do visit a retirement home and some young high schooler comes in and hugs this old man who hasn't had a hug from anyone for 20 years, yeah, there's nothing, you know, he hasn't suddenly broken the sixth commandment when he smiles. But that affection need, the need for somebody who cares. And where was I just recently said, massage is so important, but it isn't that you have to have someone, you know, kneading dough on your back. It's just that once in a while someone touches you, and it has to be the right person touching you at the right place or whatever.
There have been health studies done in extended care facilities that show that morbidity and mortality statistics are way down when there is a conscious effort to do that, particularly touch. Mm-hmm. But that whole sense of affection. Right?
And we were taught at the seminary in my day, when you visit a patient, don't touch them.
A man will resent it, and a woman might think you're taking advances.
Did you learn that too?
Yeah, oh yeah.
Did you?
Right. But Carl, I think that's more prominent today than I think over my ministry, where I am a touching person, you know, an affection, purely in a love for Christ, for one another. But I think in today's world, Pastor, has to be very careful of that.
I have no
In the last 10 years or less, maybe, I've had to be very careful. I was a chaplain for 9 years, and as you say, I loved everyone. I held the man and loved them as well as the woman and so on. It was accepted because they knew who I was and so on. But in the parish ministry today, I think the pastor has to be very careful because it's such a sensitive thing today with lawsuits and that. And I understand Hannah in Wisconsin, a young man, a wonderful, I mean, he's in his 40s now or so. But he, on the way out on Sunday mornings, after I had a Sunday where I went to church and I tried to get on a Sunday off to some of the churches that supported the group, but I knew him so well, but he hugged every person that came out of church in a real wonderful help. And the people looked forward to it, the members. I mean, kids and adults, they wouldn't go out of church until Stan. He was just such a bare kind of a loving person. No one could take him a stance for that. But even there, I think today, he has to be very careful of that. We move so far in the pendulum now that any sign, show of affection is abuse today.
Sure.
I'm glad I'm not in the parish ministry anymore today, because I'd have to keep my hands like this, just walk up to people, hi, how are you,
I guess I'm saying, I understand that, but I still think that there has to be some risk you take.
Yeah.
Loving is always risky. And it has to be genuine, and it can't be self-seeking. I'm well aware. There are times I'd love to pick up a little kid on the street and just give him a hug.
Yeah, me too.
But I'm an old man, and it's just a half minute away from somebody saying you're a dirty old man. And so, and I'm deprived of the relationship, and so is the kid, of finding a trusting relationship with an old man. So it's a tough thing to worry through, but there are different ways of showing affection too. And it doesn't have to be touch, but don't lose that. And you do have to risk that once. And you risk something when sometimes you say hello to a person. I remember in the days of the real tough, militant, black explosion, Fred Downing, who was a pastor in the south side of Chicago, or in Cabrini Green, everybody loved him. And he would go down the street and say hi to everybody. And he said hello to a young black man who was an angry black man. He says, God damn, don't you ever smile or talk to me again, white man. So you take a risk. Well, 5,000 more people he said hello to wouldn't respond that way, but it's very sobering when you do it, and that happens. New experiences, there's nothing like Dullsville. Another one of my classics involved Esther, that when we were married, had she said, what would you like most of all when you come in from the office today? And I could well have said, well, I really like a pork roast and some sweet potatoes and some applesauce and some strawberry champagne, a little glass of wine, and the evening paper. So I came home the next day, and there it is. And I come home the next day, and there it is. And I come home the next day, and there it is. And after 3 weeks of pork and sweet potatoes and champagne and a glass of wine, I'm so sick of it. And she's trying to show love to me, see? And the best thing she could say is, forget it, let's go out to Burger King, see? The people who say, we always get out. Monday night we go to bowling. Tuesday night we go to choir. Wednesday night we go to a movie. But every Monday night, every Tuesday night, Wednesday night, more often it's not that. More often it's we stay home every night and we do our thing. Just
Carl, we have never done it that way before.
Yeah.
Well put. And now comes this one. The need for recognition. After a day of doing your job at work and nobody pays any attention to you, and you come home and the other member of the family, members of the family, all feel that nobody's paid any attention to them, and they're all sort of what I call sucking their thumbs, nobody paid any attention to me. That's a bad situation, it really is. And how many times haven't housewives washed the same dishes, swept the same floor, rubbed that sweeper over the same carpet, and, you know, well, of course, and I'm at work doing my noble job there where nobody pays attention. I come home and you don't treat me as if I've worked hard all 8 hours or 9 hours if I worked overtime. And we take notice of how other people behave towards us, and the people who are very dear to us may dress for us or may treat us gently or kindly. And now, community is supposed to help you develop the response to those needs. That's why people get married, to form a very basic community where they will get security and affection and new experience and recognition, and invariably if any of those is lacking, the whole thing falls apart. Now, I want to make very clear what need is. Need is not what we normally would call the answer to the need. So the worst thing I can say to Esther is, I need you. That may sound very complimentary, but I do not need Esther. Don't yet.
You're testing us out. Let's test this
thing. I need this, I need this, I need this, I need this, and no one supplies that need better than Esther. But, you see, if I need affection, if I need her, and she isn't home, then it's the end of my life. I can pick up one of our little kids. Or I can get affection, in other words, the kind of friendliness from somebody else. Now, not the same way I get it from her. I don't care to have it for anyone. Similarly, for new experiences, my physical needs are the same thing. As far as I'm concerned, Esther's the best cook in the world. But I don't need her. I need what she can do very well. But I can go to Burger King and survive. And when Esther, or were she to die before me, it would not be the end of the world for me. It would be very, very tough, because I have these needs and I know nobody could meet them. But it's not the end of the world. And I'm going to have to find some other ways in which I can have these attended to. And I'm glad I have grandchildren, because that's going to give me affection and certainly new experiences. And they may even recognize me and say I'm the best grandfather in the world. Well, maybe. I will need security. But now, community gives us. This is why people move to retirement homes, because they're looking for these things. And the best job would be if you could get all these things there. That it would be fun going to work every day because something was new and it wouldn't be the same old grind. And if you were recognized for what you do, and if people there would say, hey, it's good to see you. We missed you when you were sick. It was really fun to have you back again. That's affection. And when you'd be compensated for it. So that would be the ideal sort of setting for this. In the neighborhood, if you could feel safe walking down the street, if when you were gone, or if you know, they'd care about the safety of your family, your wife and the children, if there wasn't the same old boring response, but people would talk with you and and maybe do things with you once in a while. And if they would recognize you with respect. Reverence and respect comes very, very close to the recognition part. I think probably what hurts people in their aging process is that there's very little reverence or respect for aging, as there once was. And by the way, I think there's very little respect and reverence by older people for young people. And they deserve it. I think there's a great tendency on part of older people to patronize youth and to ignore them and to feel, well, they don't have any experience, a put down.
Carol, I'm not sure I completely agree here.
Go ahead.
You know, and teenagers often have, because parent, in the direct relationship of parent with a teenager in the home, there is strong struggles, and there is the parental, you know, legal kind of care for them and obedience and all this kind of thing, and they're in loggerheads. Now, if they move up one generation, I have found in my working with people that often the teenager and the grandparent person have a greater relationship because now the grandparent, I'm talking about a teenager in that growing, struggling level, they aren't there with the demands, let's say, that there's the teenager is struggling to grow up. The parent is, you know, trying to hold on a little bit so they don't get too, but the grandparent is removed from that. And I found so often that for an open ear, a listening ear of respect and so on, the teenager will come to that grandparent in the nursing home and have the greatest relationship because the grandparent is free of that kind of parental care.
That's very good.
I just saw so many times, it's too bad, but that's the normal kind of thing, this struggle, you know, of growing up. And
that's one-on-one.
I once heard that grandparents and grandchildren get along so well because they have a common enemy.
I think you're right. You're absolutely right. Because the older person now has lost his control. The child has become the parent. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's another whole struggle. And so you're right. It's true that they have something in common.
But, you know, the one-on-one, it works real well. But when you are, I don't care if you're 82 or 75 or 55, when six teenagers come into a room, you know, it's a different thing. And you may say hi, but you don't want to stay long. I don't know, maybe you do. That's a tough role. And as individuals, when we take people on one-on-one, that's fine. Similarly, the youth will like to take on one older person, but doesn't want to take on 10 of them. I may be generalizing, but I think that that's valid. That's a valid observation. Now, you would like to say something, I can tell. You're bursting.
I was just thinking that, you know, for myself, the places where I have found the sort of the deepest community, though, have been completely multi-generational. That when I get with a group of my own age or whatever, it's like a special interest group. It seems, you know, I don't know how to explain it exactly, but it's just, you know, or you see, like, you talk about the retirement centers and people having security there, but to me it seems somewhat false. It's like the housing developments with all the families of the exact same age, and there's more of an image of competing with each other and trying to, you know, maintain some sort of status quo of how we're all supposed to be at a certain age. And
not only do I concur, I simply said people go to this because they look for it.
Yeah.
Only fewer than 6% of all people over 65 are in retirement homes of one sort or the other. Over 94% are either going to make it by their owner or staying with relatives or working it out some other way than just being with people they're grouping.
Yeah. Well, I think that's
fine. Yeah, I think it's good. Well, now, I just want to say one thing more. We're going to start with that tomorrow by the way of trying to see where do we clean up on this and how do we prevent it. When needs aren't met, when you have needs and they aren't met, or if especially if they have been met, but even if you've never had it, you have a sense of loss. And people even say, I'm at a loss as to what to do. And loss is invariably attended by grief. We often think of grief as being appropriate for death. A next-door neighbor of ours, whose brother was moving from the Chicago area to Virginia, his whole household, the van with everything on it caught fire and totally destroyed. And first question people asked, well, was it insured? And he would just blow up at that question, because the piano around which his mother and his brothers and sisters used to gather to sing was burned. All the sheet music that they had was burned. All the slides, the photographs of their 15-year-old son who had been killed while riding his bicycle and delivering papers, all those were gone. And everything, he said, you know, and I was with him at both the time when he lost his teenage son and the time, and there's hardly any difference. He was just as angry, and he was just as depressed, and he was just as full of blame, first at Cleveland for having narrow streets and for people not watching for kids, making kids go out and deliver papers, everything. And so when people are missing any of these and you think you've got a community going, that's when you're going to start finding blaming happening. That's when you see anger. There are people denying that the reality, this thing is really not as good. They keep telling themselves, it is good, it's the place I want. And the depression comes in, and ultimately isolation. Those are all the things that attend grieving, whether it's for death or the loss of some of these. And to try to detect these is a very, very important enterprise, but it's a very difficult thing to achieve. Loss often proliferates at the very time the person who suffers this loss can afford it. Because the big need in any loss is to be recognized as having some worth, because that which you had hoped for is and expected is gone. And when you come out of this, a person who has loss conceives of herself or himself as a loser. That's the worst kind of thing that you could possibly have for your self-esteem, than to think you're a loser. But if you've lost something, you are a loser. People talk about being the fifth wheel when three couples used to always go out, and then the one gets a divorce or one has a death, and they let this person come along like a spare tire and feels like a loser. As if there's recognition to be had because you're still hanging on to a husband or a wife, even though your marriage may have crumbled. And rarely can a person or a party, either one of them, of a broken relationship, do the healing, because both of them have my own needs. And more likely, a third party is necessary for the healing role. And we don't like to step in where there's a big conflict going on, and there's distrust, resentment, and blame, and anger, and hostility, even though it's very subtle and very covert. Now, it's appropriate to talk about this in a Christian setting, because there's nobody who gives you security like the Lord, who says, you know, I'm going to hang in there with you always, even in the end of the world, all power is given me, I'll never leave you and forsake you. I'm dependable, and maybe Valley of the Shadow of Death, I'm going to be with you. I'm going to set up my table in front of the all the things that are curling in on you, and you're going to be able to take that bread to your lips and taste the wine and remember I'm for you. And affection, where do you find any greater affection than that somebody lays down life for you? You are my friends. New experience every day. God says, here it is, a new day, and I'm going to be with you with whatever comes up, but you're going to be seeing it through my eyes. Recognition. Don't call me great God. Call me Abba, Daddy, Father, Parent. You are somebody. You are the Son of God, the body of Christ in the world. And someone has to tell you that, even though you may lose out on a whole lot of things, and we have to keep telling ourselves that, but it's hard to do it ourselves, and we need somebody to come in, as God says, with healing in the wings. Now, part of reconciliation, I think, can best be explained with an illustration I heard from George Kelsey once. He said, When a man is called home from work and said, your wife is throwing china dishes against the wall and breaking them. Now, a pastor may come in there and say, that's not nice to break dishes, because some people, the potter worked very carefully on them, and they cost a lot of money, and people worked, and they belonged to your mother-in-law, and she had them for many years. And maybe she will say, yes, that's not nice. But as soon as the pastor leaves, she's going to be ready to break another dish, or else she's going to be just sitting there frustrated and unresolved. And so George Kelsey said, the best thing the husband can do is to walk into the house and say, something must have really been bad to drive you to this distraction. And I have a feeling that I'm very likely to have been a part of it. And I don't know just exactly how, but I'm very, very sorry for it. And he said, and if you can be convincing that you are genuinely, then maybe both of you can get down on your knees and start picking up the pieces. But the moment people say, I have my rights, I got to do this, you didn't do this, it simply expands and worsens. Whenever I ask people have said this, I only want what's coming to me. It seems fair enough, but you hope God isn't overhearing. So when the things crumble, you can't walk away from it, because it's critical. It's a crisis, and a crisis calls for a moment of decision, for choosing. And decide to put it off is to decide to let it get more critical. You're actually making a decision to let it keep riding. And just as in alcohol addiction, the person who says, well, I don't want to talk with it now, is found to be, they call him an enabler. I don't like that, because it has a positive ring to it. I like the word aider or abettor. Somebody who's aiding or abetting this person in a situation to get worse and worse. There has to be some intervention that finally says, no, this is wrong. And how you do it, if in this community people are destroying each other, you can't simply say, well, get together again. We've often talked about marriages as needing reconciliation, as if people who get together again have reconciled. They may still be misfits. Reconciling means fit. And if we are truly life givers, as Jesus Christ intends us to be, then we must always be doing something that's going to enrich and ennoble and beautify this life. It affirms it at its best.